IPCC predictions already show us that even if we stopped all greenhouse gases emissions today, temperatures will still rise. And for some ecosystems, that can be lethal.
This is The Butterfly Effect, a podcast that shows the big impact a small action can do. Tali Orat is talking to those special people that make a difference with nature and trees.
Welcome everyone to The Butterfly Effect. My name is Tali Orad. I'm your host and your butterfly here. My special guest today is Clara Botto. Clara has been engaged with sustainable development at a grassroots and international level, from art to politics, for the past 8 years. She is currently developing the initiative SRM Youth Watch, which is looking into the governance of climate-altering technologies called solar radiation modification, SRM. Clara campaigns with World's Youth for Climate Justice, seeking an advisory options from the International Court of Justice on the climate crisis as a human rights issue. She is a new European voice on existential risk with European Leadership Network and is the science policy thematic facilitator of the major group of children and youth to the UNEP. Clara holds a master's degree in international development and public policy and a bachelor's degree in business. Welcome, Clara, to the Butterfly Effect.
Thank you, Tali. It's great to be here.
So you've been actively engaged in sustainable development at both grassroots and international level for the past 8 years. Can you share some of the key milestones and experience that have shaped your journey into this field?
Milestones for me are something hard to describe because for me, every day is as important as any other day. Being out in the street with fellow colleagues and activists is very powerful for me. So back in Brazil, 6 years ago, for example, protesting for animal rights and welfare, and then seeing that being translated into law and regulations, that's something that always makes me really happy to see, that we as humans, as individuals, when we get together, we become stronger. All of the opportunities I've had of being in spaces like the UN Human Rights Council or the UN headquarters, and having the chance of saying the things I want to, and having that being recorded and in public, that could also be a milestone, because I know that our voice matters, especially when we're representing a much larger group. Seeing your passions and your dreams becoming real in the international or national sphere, that is something that makes me more hopeful about the future.
Yeah. So you woke up one day and decided, I'm gonna change the world?
No, not really. It's not part of my plan to change the world. I think we change ourselves. I mean, the world is fine and will keep on being fine, the planet as a living creature. The problem are the humans. The problem's the humans. And so I never say that I want to change the world, but rather be a better human every day. And if I can inspire others that are around me to also follow that path, then I think that's more of my mission than changing the world.
So your current initiative, SRM Youth Watch, focuses on the governance of solar radiation modification, right? The SRM technologies. Could you explain, first of all, what is SRM?
So SRM, as you said, stands for solar radiation modification. And these are technologies basically to reflect solar radiation back into space, thus cooling the Earth. And these are not solutions to the climate crisis, and they do not address greenhouse gases emissions, but they might be an option for us to prevent more catastrophic events from happening if we can cool down some certain regions or even the whole planet. The problem is science is still not very clear on what are all of the risks of those technologies, but research is fast advancing. So we don't want to run the risk of having countries unilaterally deciding to deploy those technologies without having a global consensus before, because then we might risk just making the climate crisis, like the problems that derive from the climate crisis, even worse.
It is not like carbon capturing technology or geoengineering. How is it different exactly?
Yeah, so geoengineering is an umbrella term, and inside that you have solar radiation modification and you have carbon capture as well. So for years, people were just referring to geoengineering when they wanted to talk about SRM. But now, because carbon capture technologies are more advanced and like they're not only being researched in labs, for example, there was the necessity to divide those two terms and refer themselves isolated.
Okay. So what are the primary goals of the SRM technology in addressing right climate change, and what are the potential benefits that they offer?
The ultimate benefit is reducing temperature, and that can happen both at a local scale or on a global scale, because some technologies, they have this impact of cooling the whole planet.
So it's cooling the planet without removing the emissions that keeps the climate warm.
Yes. So that's why it's not a silver bullet solution.
Okay. Are there any notable SRM technologies currently in development or in testing stages that you believe hold the premise of addressing those issues?
So the most researched and maybe the most known technology is called stratospheric aerosol injection, SAI. And this one is the one I mentioned that has a global impact, and it consists of injecting sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. This idea came from monitoring the impact of volcano eruptions, because scientists saw that this, like, following volcanic eruptions, the temperature, the mean temperature reduces, and so this proposition of stratospheric aerosol injection would be mimicking that on a global scale. But there have been no few tests for this technology. The only SRM technology that has been, or that is still being tested out in the field work, is called marine cloud brightening. And as the name says, you're literally trying to brighten the marine clouds. And this is currently happening in Australia. So earlier this year, I was there with the research team as an observer. And yeah, I would say that this is the most developed research we have for deployment of SRM technologies.
And how far are we from actually having them deployed everywhere?
We're still far because, again, like I said, we still don't know all of the risks that comes with those technologies. Mm-hmm. We don't have any agreements, even in a national level, to determine how we will use those technologies, for how long, who's going to pay for that, and all the logistics to have deployment happening as well. So right now, it's just very naive and immature to talk about deployment, but maybe in 5-10 years from now, we could potentially have science ready for it. So the sooner we start the governance discussions about it, the better.
I see. Okay. And you were talking about not knowing all the risks. Do you know some of the potential risks or unintended consequences?
We know that it might impact rainfall patterns. So either creating more droughts or more floods, depending on the area, and then this in turn impacts crops, so food stocks. We know it might also have an impact on human health, because in some places having more aerosols can mean facilitating, for example, malaria outbreaks. There are also the geopolitical risks of those technologies being used as a weapon, because in your territory, for example, you like research might tell you that rainfall patterns won't be affected, but if you know that your neighbor might be negatively impacted, one could use that as a weapon, really. Well, another one is a term called termination shock, which is also, we still don't know what happens when we stop using those technologies. Does temperature like rapidly go high again? We don't know that. And how will ecosystems readjust to an abrupt change in temperature if that happens?
With all those risks, knowing them, which is honestly very scary and reminds me of the invention of the atomic bomb, why not just drop it and basically change course and focus all the energy towards the carbon removal, which eventually will lead to temperature drops and balancing of the system? Why continue focusing on that?
IPCC predictions already show us that even if we stopped all greenhouse gases emissions today, temperatures will still rise. And for some ecosystems, that can be lethal. In the Great Barrier Reef, for example, the reef can't withstand a warmer world still. So this technology, marine called brightening, for example, could be a chance to preserve at least the mother reefs, which are the ones that provide life for the rest of the reef, and hope that if we can at least save those mother reefs, we can restore the other ones in the coming years. Or preserving Arctic ice melt, mm-hmm. because carbon capture won't make the ice melt slower. And for communities there at the front line in the Arctic region, that could also, I mean, it won't only prevent the ice from melting, but preserve their culture and their livelihood. So these are only some of the two examples where we see there's also a need to, there might be a need to cool those areas. Carbon capture on its own might actually be harmful, because if we take too much carbon at once out of our atmosphere, there will be an imbalance in the oceans. They will become even more acid. So it can't be one of the other. It's a combination of all the things we should already been doing, right?
And in the context of your SIM Youth Watch initiative, what specific actions or research are you undertaking to monitor and advocate for responsible governments of the SRM technologies?
So SRM Youth Watch is an initiative that I'll be working on until COP28 this year, so until December. It was a final project from a year long of activities I had with the Carnegie Climate Governance Initiative. Mm-hmm. And I set it up because I really understood that if we don't bring the younger generations on board of this discussion as well, it will be even harder for us to regulate those technologies in the future. And regulate might mean saying that we do not want to use those technologies. But for that, we also need science to be clear and decision makers to understand what they're doing, right? And a huge problem in climate and environmental negotiations is that oftentimes the negotiators, they don't know what they're negotiating on. They receive like a brief presentation a couple of minutes before entering the negotiation room. And for SRM, this just can't happen, because this is something that has global, well, all the negotiations have global impact, but like this has no, we don't have precedent for SRM governance. And so again, the sooner we equip the younger generation to understand what those technologies are, the better. And this is for all areas of knowledge, from arts to health to engineering. It doesn't matter, you name it, there's a role for everyone to play in this.
Yeah, and education, and also bringing scientists into the discussions. They hold the information. Yeah.
Yeah, and there are also young scientists that are already doing research on this, but they don't feel part of a community of scientists from all around the world that are also looking into that. For me, it's also key that we have the principles of climate and intergenerational justice always in hand when we're talking about those technologies, because if not, it might just be used as one more way of colonialism from developed countries towards not so developed countries, or just making decisions for the future generations without knowing if that might actually be better for them or not. And then, like I said, I'll be doing a thorough youth watch until COP, and I've actually already started working with an organization called the Alliance for Just Deliberation on Solar Geoengineering. And I'll be developing a youth program with them to have this broad engagement of young people from all around the world and from different areas of knowledge into this discussion too.
That's very important. And I want to use that kind of like to a segue for another topic. I know you were also involved in a com in campaigns with World Youth for Climate Justice seeking an advisory option from the International Court of Justice on the climate crisis as a human rights issue. So what do you hope to achieve through this campaign, and how do you see it impacting climate justice efforts?
So this campaign started with Pacific Island students. They were mostly law students that decided, well, if countries at an international stage, they're not really making bold decisions, and our livelihoods here in the Pacific are and will be strongly impacted by the climate crisis, why don't we ask the highest court in the world what they think about it? And so this campaign started there in the Pacific, and now it's a global campaign. And we have already moved through different stages of the campaign. First, it was really raising awareness of it and presenting what we wanted to the countries. So I don't know if you know the process to request an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice, but first the countries have to agree at the UN that they want to request this advisory opinion to the International Court of Justice. And the country who decided to take this matter into their hands was Vanuatu. And so they brought this up at the UN. The countries didn't even vote for it. It was a consensus. But I mean, I'm telling it as if it was that simple, but no, that took years to get Vanuatu to bring this to the UN and to have the countries agreeing on this. Now the court is collecting the inputs from member states, because the main idea from this advisory opinion is that the court will say what are countries, so what are member states' responsibilities when it comes to the climate crisis, with a focus on human rights. And of course, there are other questions, but for me, this is like the heart of this advisory opinion. The judges from the court will give this advisory opinion based on the inputs that the countries are sending to the court. This might include cases of communities that have already lost their territory because of the climate crisis, or climate activists that are being persecuted by their governments. We don't know what will be sent to the court, but for some countries, we also hope that there will be an annex where young people from that country can add their own requests to the court. Not necessarily requests, but evidence. And then after that, which, if I'm not mistaken, the court will be receiving those written inputs until January. And then after that, there will be also oral hearings there at the court, which is located in The Hague. And then the judges will deliberate on what their advisory opinion is. The advisory opinions from the court, they're not binding, but they serve like a guide to countries on to countries or NGOs or lawyers that have to decide on climate litigation cases, for example. Mm-hmm. Because the International Court of Justice, like I said, is the highest court we have on the planet. And so having a document from them stating what our country's obligations will be really meaningful, we hope. I mean, we hope that the judges will say that the countries are responsible for addressing and minimizing the impact of the climate crisis and all that. But then now we can only hope that they will be as bold as possible.
You also said something about bold decisions that are not being made. Can you give some example of that?
I mean, the fact that we still haven't been able to cut greenhouse gases emissions or drastically lower them. Mm-hmm. I understand that cutting is not that simple, but we, like in some countries, so far behind from the Paris agreements. And I guess that's just a problem of the UN, that the decisions are not binding. But then it's just very sad that we have countries signing a piece of paper but not really sticking up to that. And yeah, that's just an example. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And as a new European voice on existential risk with European Leadership Network, can you share some insight into the concept of those existential risks and the role they're playing in shaping global politics and strategies?
So we have different existential risks. Maybe the ones that come to mind first are nuclear or biological risks. But within this program, I'm focused on SRM, on solar radiation modification, because there are some pretty catastrophic scenarios that we can think from deploying or the lack of deployment from those technologies. And so, yeah, that's what I'm focusing on.
And then you have another hat, which you serve as the science policy thematic facilitator of the major group of children and youth to UNEP. So how do you see the role of youth in shaping environmental and sustainable development policy? And we talked a little bit about it when you mentioned bringing them to the table to talk. But what are some of the key issues you're addressing in this capacity?
I think for the past couple of years, young people have been more recognized as valuable stakeholders in this international and intergovernmental sphere. Again, don't know if you know, but the UN has formal engagement mechanisms with civil society in the form of constituencies. UNEP, for example, the environmental program, their youth constituency is called CYMG. So like you read, Children and Youth Major Group. And the constituencies are all comprised of volunteers that want to contribute to these UN processes, and this goes for different UN bodies. That means, at least from the youth constituency, that we are usually requested to provide our opinion on matters that are being discussed by UNEP, that we can attend UNEP conferences and be kind of like a watchdog for UNEP, mm-hmm. from like carrying this youth hat, and then being in person in those spaces. That means we might also have the chance to contribute with written or oral statements. But again, this is not formally part of the UN, but it's just an engagement mechanism that they have to broaden the discussions with civil society. And then inside the constituencies, we divide in thematic areas. And so young people can get engaged with whatever they see more connected to their areas of work or study.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And can you share a success story or an initiative that you've been part of that has had a meaningful impact on either advancing sustainable development or climate action?
This case of the International Court of Justice is one of the projects I've been engaged that makes me most proud of, because it really shows how a small group of people can really catalyze action and bring this to such important spaces. And like, it spreads, right? It's not only us that that are responsible for this anymore. It has become a common good for all of humanity, and it always makes me so happy when I'm like in a panel, not necessarily speaking, like I'm just listening to what they're saying, and I hear someone mentioning like, oh, there were young people who brought this to the International Court of Justice, and I'm like, wow, yeah, it ripples, you know. For me, this is one of the examples that makes me not necessarily happy, because we still don't have the advisory opinion, but like it does make me more hopeful that when we have a good idea and we get together, we can make things happen.
Yeah. So looking to the future, what are your long-term goals and aspiration in the realm of sustainable development and climate justice?
For me, I think I'll be working for the rest of my life with solar radiation modification governance or emerging climate technologies which are still not regulated. I think I had known that for a while already, maybe for the past 5 years. And I'm just really concerned of this whole green growth narrative or green economy, where we're just using the same narratives of exploitation and appropriation of spaces and peoples and cultures, but branding it as if it's something good. Mm-hmm. So I think like for the rest of my life, I will be fighting those solutions which might not be so good, and if they are good, making them as just as possible. I mean, the decisions made on them as just as possible, so that we don't have the same marginalized groups that have historically been suffering with colonialism and capitalism. I just think we need to break from this cycle of always having people that are not heard.
Mm-hmm. And is this something that you think our listeners can do?
First of all, educating yourself on, I mean, specifically on SRM, I would say learn as much as you can, because this topic is like a snowball. Only this year, 2023, so many things happened in the international sphere that hadn't happened for maybe the past 20 years or the previous 10 years, where this topic was started to be more researched. And I think it should be in our radars, because this will impact our life, you know. And again, we don't have any formal governance mechanisms for it, but it might come the time where we will have a global framework to regulate those things. And if we can have a deliberative process of really consulting with citizens, it will be great if citizens already know what we're deliberating on. And so I would say for now, just have it on your radar. You can not necessarily read the news, but you can read climate fiction books that talk about it. You can watch series that talk about it. And yeah, just start forming your own opinion on how you feel about those technologies.
Yeah. And the more real information you have, the better.
Yeah.
Okay. So you talked a little bit about geoengineering, which put the SRM on the one side of the umbrella, and then obviously carbon capturing on the other side of the umbrella. And one of the things of carbon capturing is obviously trees. So I'm going to ask you what I ask every guest. What is your favorite tree?
My favorite tree. I can't explain why it's my favorite tree, but whenever someone asks me, it's always the one that comes to my mind. It's called Araucaria. And I don't think that there's a name in English for it. Araucaria. It's a coniferous tree. It's in the, I mean, at least in Brazil, it's in the mountain regions and in the south of Brazil. Yeah, it's an evergreen coniferous tree. And I don't know, I just find it so beautiful.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Clara. I really appreciate the chatting with you and learning about SRM. And I hope you guys were inspired. So thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for joining me today. We are all beautiful butterflies, each in his and her individual ways. I wanted to thank you for joining me today in this episode. I really appreciate you coming on this journey with me, and I hope you can join me next time. And remember, it only takes a small action to make a big difference. Be a butterfly.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. Please subscribe to hear more of our stories of change.